So I'll begin by saying that the topic I have chosen is a challenging topic, and the more I dug into it, the more I began to second-guess myself. Am I really competent for this? It's challenging for a number of reasons. Any speaker faces the reality that he comes from an imperfect family. If he has a family, it's an imperfect family. He's imperfect himself. So he's not going to feel very well qualified speaking about the family. But we have to go to the scriptures and just point out what the scriptures teach and seek to aim at that standard. We know we aren't going to meet the standard perfectly, of course, but it is good to remind us what we should be aiming at. Any speaker also faces the challenge of his own inexperience. I probably have less experience running a family than most of the men here on the panel. And then even if you do have a lot of experience with the family, there may be quite a few cases that you're not familiar with yourself, particular challenges, particular situations that families are in, and you didn't face that when you were raising a family. And so I think no matter how much experience you have, you're still going to feel your inexperience. Okay, and then there's also the challenge that every family is in different circumstances. So a huge variety of circumstances that families can be in. I've just thought of a few. You could probably think of many, of more. Some families have a lot of children. Some families don't. Some families have a lot of little children close together in age. Some have them more spaced apart. health of the family really impacts the family and what it can and cannot do. Maybe some of the children have disabilities, and there's some families all the children are very healthy, and there are no disabilities. And then other families have to deal with a child that might have a learning disability, a mental disability, physical disability, and this profoundly impacts their family life. Another thing that affects family is their location, where they live. Family in the city faces very different circumstances from a family in a country. Some families are in very good neighborhoods, some are in very bad neighborhoods. So that's really going to affect where they let their children go, what they do on a daily basis, and so forth. So these are all things that really affect family life on a daily basis. Bereavement hugely impacts a family. If the father dies, the mother dies, the child dies, this permanently affects the family in a major way. And so their family life, again, is going to differ a lot from others. Another challenging aspect of speaking about the family is that we have to set realistic expectations. We live in a fallen world, and no matter how much grace we are given, we are going to be imperfect, and that applies to our families too. Our families are going to be imperfect. And so we have to be realistic about what we can accomplish in this world regarding the family.
Was that meant for me, that part?
Did you say expectations? No, I have no one in mind in particular. The reason I actually decided to put this up is because my mind went back maybe 15 years ago. I had to visit another lady, a lady in another country. And she was an older lady, very, very godly lady. And she was a wonderful, loving mother. I mean, her children just loved her dearly and really highly esteemed for her godliness. And I went to see her, I think with another friend, and she had just gotten done reading a book on parenting or being a mother. And one of the first things she said was, I've just completed reading this book on parenting and I feel like such a failure. Yeah, and I think it was a relatively modern book on parenting. And I think a lot of parenting books can do this inadvertently. They can set out how the family should be, and they leave you feeling very, very deflated, to say the least. Yeah. So we have to set realistic expectations. Now, the encouragement is, marriage and the family is a relic of paradise. My friends in the Sabbath school in Gisborne will recognize that phrase. We've been going through the Ten Commandments in the Sabbath school, and I came across this really beautiful phrase describing marriage and the family. It's a relic of paradise. Because it was marriage and the family was instituted in paradise before the fall. And it still continues to this day. What was the other relic of paradise?
Yeah. The
Sabbath. The Sabbath, yes. So marriage and the Sabbath are called the two relics of paradise. Uh-huh. And another encouragement is the fact that it is a divine institution. It's been established by God. And therefore, it's been instituted by someone of infinite wisdom. And therefore, the family is so well designed by God that even struggling families can still be a means of blessing to members within the family and to others outside the family. Families that have gone through very, very sore trials and struggle with a lot of challenges in their daily life. Because it's still a family that's been instituted by God, that family can still be a means of blessing to the children and parents within the family, as well as a means of blessing to those outside the family. Now, next thing I want to say about this lecture is it is an unusual lecture. Probably the men here don't recall lecture quite like this, given at a youth conference. And if we have time, I am going to get into things that maybe aren't generally covered at a youth conference. Things I believe are entirely biblical. But when I was looking through these slides, I was asking myself, why is it that this seems unusual? And I think one reason is collective wisdom about the family has been lost. So we have the proverb, a good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children. That's not just speaking about wealth, but a lot of things. The collective wisdom that, parents gain after a lifetime of parenting should be handed down to their children. And due to attacks on the family for the last 200 years or more, I believe that there's been a lot of hindrances to collective wisdom being passed down. Another thing that makes this lecture unusual is I think in the past, a lot of collective wisdom about marriage and family was passed down just from parents to children. And it was kind of assumed that this would happen, that there's going to be collective wisdom passed down generation to generation. And so maybe ministers didn't, preach sermons or give lectures on marriage and family, because it was just assumed that these are things that are going to be dealt with in private. But I don't think we can make that assumption anymore for a couple of reasons. The French Revolution was a huge event in European history. It occurred in the late 1700s. And you could say it was a rebellion against everything. France had been under the tyranny of the Roman Catholic Church, as well as the tyranny of the king. And after being under tyranny for so long by the church and the state, a movement just rose up and tried to rebel against everything. The institution of the family, the institution of the current government, and the institution of the church, which was very corrupt. So they basically said that to protect people from oppression, we need to get away from all these traditional structures like the patriarchy. You hear that phrase today, people saying the West is has been really, really damaged by patriarchy. That's an entirely biblical phrase. Patriarchy just means father rule. You have the word patriarchs in the Bible. So there's nothing wrong with the concept of patriarchy in itself. It's just how patriarchy is done. Really, that's where the problem lies. The abuse of patriarchy is the problem, but not patriarchy itself. So the French Revolution, the leading thinkers basically said it's the individual is the basic unit of society, not the family. And that was revolutionary. It's hard to imagine now. There's so much stress on the individual today. Everybody takes for granted that as soon as you're 18, you should have the right to vote. Well, that was actually very rare. That was unheard of back then. Back then, it was, generally speaking, heads of households that should vote in elections because they represent the household. So it's the politics was driven more by household voting rather than individual voting. And the thinking was that, well, when only heads of households vote, they're going to be thinking more long term. They're going to be thinking not just about their own personal needs, but they're going to be thinking about the needs of their children and what policies are good for their children. So they're more future oriented. And if you look at surveys from America, voting results, I love to look at them, not just because I'm an American, but because the data is so extensive. And one thing that's really interesting about election returns is how people vote according to their state of merit, whether they're married or not, whether they have children or not. And it's proven every single election, the people who are married with children are always more conservative. Okay, so anyway, the point is that French Revolution really shifted the focus from the family to the individual. And so with that came this idea, very popular today, that marriage and family relationships are voluntary. They're not permanent. The relationships are more like contracts. Like, I'll stay married as long as it satisfies my needs. That's really the thinking of today. And that kind of thinking really got going at the French Revolution. Sadly, it's not just marriages. It affects parents. Parents say, "Well, I'll happily raise this child and own him as my child as long as I'm getting what I want from this child. And then if they shame me, if they humiliate me, I'll disown them and pretend like they're not my child." And same with children and parents. Many sad stories of children just disowning their parents. And again, it's this idea that the relationship of parents and children are almost voluntary. You know, we it's like a contract between them. And if it's working, the contract holds good. If it's not working, we break the contract and there's no relationship anymore. So breakdown of the family stops collective wisdom from being passed down from generation to generation. That's what we're seeing in society in general. Now, families, and most of you are from Reformed families, and you're somewhat protected from the attack made on the family. Families in Reformed churches for generations have been protected against this revolutionary thinking about the family that we see working all throughout society. And so families that have been in Reformed churches have enjoyed collective wisdom being passed down from generation to generation. But, okay, well, here's an example, collective wisdom. People naturally have differences. There's difference. We'll get into this later if time allows. People have particular personality traits, intelligence traits. They're born with these differences, and that affects marriage compatibility, right? Now, what was really revolutionary about the French Revolution and Marxism and communism, which arose out of the French Revolution, is that all differences amongst human beings should be ignored. We should just focus on the fact that we are humans. The common humanity is all that we should think about. And so obviously this affects people's choice of a marriage partner. They're not so alert maybe to the natural differences, and therefore the natural compatibility or incompatibility of the person they want to marry. Now people, another thing we have to remember, most of you come from families that are Reformed, and maybe some of you come from families that have been in the Reformed Church for generations. I think there's some here, their ancestors go back to 1893 and before. Every generation, parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and beyond, you know, they've all been in a Reformed church, either in Scotland or in Holland. Right? So there's a lot of benefit to that, and it's easy to overlook it. If you come from a family that has been in the Reformed church for generations, there's a good chance that a lot of useful collective wisdom is being handed down to you. But it's important to remember that increasingly in Reformed churches, there are people that are coming out of families that had no religion, like my father, for instance. So they're not just learning about the Reformed faith, but they're learning about how to be a husband, how to be a wife, how to be a father. They came from maybe shattered family situations. And so they're not just learning about Reformed doctrine and worship and the Christian life, but they're learning about just basic family duties, which other generations, it might have just been almost an instinct. You know, you knew how to be a father because you had a good father yourself. Then, of course, there are families within Reformed churches that may have lost this collective wisdom. Now, these are some of the things that really were standing out to me when I was reading books on the family, is that the more you dig into the history of the family, the more you realize there's a lot of collective wisdom that's been lost. Okay. All right, so coming to the introduction, what makes humans different from the angels? This will kind of bring out the uniqueness of the family. Several answers to this. Just prep. Go ahead, Timothy. Angels, yep. Angels don't have bodies. Matthew?
There's no salvation. Salvation is only for humans.
That's right. All right. Fallen angels have no possibility of salvation. Yeah. That's maybe comprehended in the term covenant. God made a covenant with Adam originally. We don't read of a covenant with the angels. And then after Adam's fall, God revealed a covenant of grace. Angels are included in the covenant of grace, but they're not objects of salvation, right? Another thing that I think makes humans different from angels is that they have been given dominion over all the earth. The earth was formed for us, human beings, not for the angels. And God gave dominion to the race of man, dominion over the earth. And of course, another thing that makes us different from the angels is the fact that there's such a thing as marriage and family. With the angels, God created them all at once. Right? There's no angels that are born, obviously. So humans were not all created at once as the angels were. And so this really brings out the uniqueness of the human race. Humans were not created at full maturity. Adam and Eve were, of course, but ever since. That humans are born as infants, and they grow, develop, mature within a family. And this is God's will, that humans come into existence within a family. And they, as I said, it's also his will that all humans grow, develop, and mature within a family. So now the importance of the family. Firstly, that it's very important because it was instituted by God in the Garden of Eden. when God brought the woman to the man and united them in marriage, that was then the time when family was instituted. And therefore, family existed before there was a church formed, or a state, or a nation, or whatever you want to call it. The family exists before things like the church and the state, which means that the family is necessary for the church and state to exist. Family is the building block, fundamental building block of both church and state. No family, no church, basically. Then we find in Scripture the Lord constantly emphasizing the importance of family. God sets the solitary in families, sets the poor on high from affliction, and maketh them families like a flock. Psalm 107. We see the importance of family in the fact that whole families are baptized. So the theme running throughout the book of Acts, household baptism. The Philippian jailer, for instance, he and his whole household was baptized. We read Genesis 17 earlier about how Abraham and his children and servants, all the males within his household, all circumcised. That was the Old Testament sacrament of admission into the visible church. It's now been replaced by baptism. And so, the baptism ideally should be a family sacrament, you might say. A family sacrament. And then we read in the Bible that whole families will be blessed in Christ. And the Lord says to Jacob, "In thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed." These are just a few reasons why the family is so important. Another very important reason, which I've mentioned, I think, to the Sabbath School in Gisborne, is that whole churches have arisen from one family. You see that with Abraham. You see that with Cornelius in Acts chapter 10. Another lesser-known example would be Nymphas. We read about the church that was in his house. Same with Philemon or Philemon. There was a church in his house. And so whole churches have arisen from one family. And I understand that the Gisborne congregation was really an example of a congregation that developed out of one family originally. Just one godly lady who was blessed with many children, and she wrestled in prayer for the conversion of her children, and that also wrestled in prayer that the Lord would provide spouses for her children. And she was a lady by the name of Mary McPherson, is that correct? And really, the Gisborne congregation owes existence under God, of course, to that one family. So that's probably one reason why the family is so fiercely attacked today. And something that families should remember if they're going through really hard times and it feels like they're just experiencing one blow after another. Well, maybe Satan sees that the Lord is going to build a church out of your family. The Bible speaks about Rachel and Leah building the house of Israel. Very, very high honor conveyed to mothers, a sense in which they build the church. Right, so we should come to the institution of the family. It goes back to Genesis, of course. And we have to start with the fact that God created man male and female in his own image. He created them first as individuals. He didn't create them in the married state, but he didn't create them at the same time. He created them as individuals. And so there's an important practical lesson to that, and that is that both man and woman have equal value, both made in his own image. And all throughout history, this has been attacked. Many, many attacks on the equal worth of men and women polygamy. Today you have polygamy in the Middle East, which is, causes a lot of suffering amongst women, of course. And we have the abortion of females in China. And then maybe in the West, you have the idea of that fathers are no longer needed. Right, so we can do just fine without men. These are all ways in which the equal worth of men and women are attacked. Now, another important thing to notice is that in Genesis, God created the man first, then the woman. And we know that's important because Paul draws attention to it in 1 Timothy chapter 2. He says, "For Adam was first formed, then Eve." So that's one reason why men are to lead in the church and in the family. The man was created first, and then the woman. But as we've already said, that doesn't mean the woman is any less human, since God clearly created man, male and female, in his own image. So the point is that there can be equality, but at the same time, a certain kind of order or subordination. And the modern world just can't understand that. They think that for there to be equality, everybody's got to have the same role, have the same amount of power, and so forth. But no, it's possible for there to be order and people under authority, and they're still just as human as the person that's over them in authority. Okay, so after he created man and woman, he brought them together in marriage. The rib which the Lord God had taken from man made he a woman and brought her unto the man. So, as I said already, both were created in God's image before they were married. So, a practical lesson from this is that being single, if that is the Lord's will, is not less honorable. We hear, you know, kind of humorous statements like, a man is not a complete man until he gets a wife. And, you know, we laugh at that, and there's an element of truth in it. But, you know, be careful here. You know, a person, whether they're married or not, is still a person that was originally made in the image of God. And you have strange ideas that arise even in the church from time to time. We have the huge problem of the Roman Catholic Church that said that priests could not be married. That's introduced all kinds of corruption and misery into the Roman Catholic Church because they forbid the clergy, as they call it, to get married. But then, you know, in some cases we see an opposite extreme where, you know, maybe a Protestant church will actually require the minister to be married. If he's going to be ordained, he has to be married first. And the problem with that is that there were preachers in the Bible that were not married. The Lord Jesus himself, the Apostle Paul, Jeremiah was commanded not to take a wife. And so it is certainly an error to require that ministers be married. But having said that, it's also equally clear from the Bible that marriage and having children is the usual state of most adults. That is the usual state. So paradise and the flood were both times when all the adults alive were all married. Adam and Eve are the only adults in paradise. They were married. The eight people on the ark are all adults who were married. So, yes, I don't want to in any way denigrate marriage. I just want to strike the biblical balance here. Now, we come to the purpose of the family, and here we lean on the Westminster Confession of Faith. Westminster Confession of Faith says that marriage is for the mutual help of husband and wife, for the increase of mankind with a legitimate issue, and of the church with an holy seed, and for preventing of uncleanness. So there's four purposes there. Mutual help of husband and wife, increase of mankind with a legitimate issue, and the third purpose, to give the church a holy seed. We're hearing about that earlier in the conference, seed of God, is it? And also for the preventing of uncleanness. So the first and last purposes of marriage apply to all married couples, whether they're able to have children or not. Some people get married very late in life and then are not able to have children, or maybe they're younger and for some reason they can't have children. But marriage is for the mutual help of husband and wife, and also for the preventing of uncleanness. The second and third purposes relate to what is sometimes called the dominion mandate, or is it the creation mandate? Something that's to that effect, the dominion mandate. And that's based on Genesis 1, verse 27. God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So we learn from this that marriage is not simply for mutual happiness. There's a purpose for it. God ordained that marriage be the way that the earth be filled with human beings made after his own image. And this is how the whole world is going to be subdued and made fruitful. And that's very important today. The world thinks that human beings are a parasite, a great burden on the environment, when no, God has made man the Lord of the universe. The earth needs man to be correctly stewarded and fruitful. And so, for this to happen, there needs to be marriage and family. God has formed the earth to be inhabited, and it's going to be inhabited by human beings all over through marriage and family. So related to this is that the Bible clearly speaks about the Lord opening and closing the womb. It's He that gives children. Today there's a great emphasis on married couples just traveling, enjoying themselves, pursuing a career, pursuing their own interests, and family is having children is very, very far down on the list, if at all. And this flies in the face of verses in the Bible that speak of the Lord opening and closing the womb. So the key point here is that married couples should aim to accomplish something. That's what God intended, that married couples should be accomplishing something in the earth. They're like a team. Husband and wife are like a team. And as they bring up family, they're trying to do their part of in subduing the earth, replenishing it, and so on. And marriages will have a lot of problems if they forget this. Marriage is for mutual happiness and satisfaction, but if it just becomes focused on themselves, having a good time, it won't be long before they find it really empty, very disappointing. Okay, so now we come to family and everyday life. A lot of practical lessons about life in this world are first learned in the family. You could call it a school for all of life. I think that's what I put down on a later slide. It's like family is like a school for all of life. Just about all the relationships you will have and the duties of those relationships you will have with other people in life. You learn valuable lessons about how to navigate those relationships in your own family when you're a child. And we'll give examples of this later. Okay, but now I'm going to step back and again point out something that's relevant to today. We hear a lot about equality. We hear a lot about the injustice of inequality and oppression, and people in positions of power, like traditionally the patriarch, the man who's the head of the house, We often hear that this is the cause of so much misery and oppression and unfairness, the fact, the old Christian idea that the man is the head of the house. But you know, there's some really important lessons to remember about equality in the whole equality debate today. And that the first is that everyone in the family is equally human. Whether they're adults, whether they're children, whether they're strong, whether they're weak, whether they're talented, whether they're disabled, can't even take care of themselves, they're still equally human with the head of the home. Whether they're dependent or helpless, they're born, unborn, whatever their condition, they're still human beings. They still have souls that are worth more than the whole world. Right? So that is the, you might say, the foundation for true equality. And the world today has thrown out the idea that man, every human being, has a soul worth more than the whole world. And so they have to come up with a different way of establishing equality among human individuals. They'll say, well, you know, the way we make everybody equal is making sure they all have the same amount of civil rights, for instance. Whereas we would say, well, whether I have a civil right or not, doesn't affect my worth as a human being. Whether I'm in a position of power in politics or in the church, that doesn't affect my human worth, right? You know, if I'm high class, low class, middle class, that doesn't affect my human worth. My human worth is established by the fact that I've been made in the image of God. So everyone in the family is equally human, but no one in the family has the same role. I don't think there's any instance. I mean, ordinarily, everybody's of a different age, for one. So just that fact is going to mean that just about every person in the family has somewhat of a different role. Yeah. And the older children are going to have responsibilities that the younger children don't have. Now, boys might have some responsibilities that girls don't have. Right? So, some have authority. Some others have to submit or obey in the family. Our role in the family is determined by things like our age, our maturity, our talents, and so forth. And so in the family, we are to learn that we all must embrace our role, whether it's the man as the head of the house, he has to embrace that role and all the responsibility that comes with it. Whether it's the wife who is to submit to the husband and bear children, guide the house, she has to bear that. She has to embrace that role. The child has to embrace the role of being under the authority of their parents, and the role they might have as a younger child, and not able to do something that the older child can do. They all have to embrace these roles, and see them importantly, and see that as appointed by God. It's really striking that we come into this world and there's so many things that are predetermined. Whether you're male, whether you're female, the kind of family you have, where you were born, the circumstances of your upbringing, all of that was out of your control. It was all predetermined by God. And we have to remember that it was all predetermined by a wise and holy God. And he has wise, sovereign reasons for predetermining so much of my early life. So a very important lesson about family and everyday life is that when we learn our role in the family, it helps us embrace our role in the church, or embracing the role that we will have in a family of our own someday. I remember speaking with a minister in Scotland some time ago about the interesting providence we find more and more as we go through adult life. We encounter situations and we say, I went through something like this as a child. I didn't understand it at the time, why I went through that as a child. But now I see that childhood experience was really helpful for the position that I'm in right now. Yeah. And sometimes in the workplace, you know, or in the church, and so forth. I'm getting ahead of myself, but in the family, there's the head of the home, and office bearers are to be those who know how to rule their own families. And you know, the longer I have a family, and I'm sure the men here found this too, the more you see what an excellent training ground it is for your duties as elders or ministers. As parents, you love all your children, even though they have different talents, different abilities. Some can do a lot for you, some can do nothing for you, but you still love them all. Some may be converted, others may be unconverted, but they're all your children, so you want to see them living together in harmony. And that, of course, is the desire of an office bearer. You know, that he's been placed by God over a congregation. Some in the congregation are converted, some are unconverted, some have a lot of talent, some don't have as much talent. But he loves them all, and he wants to see them all working together in harmony. And so a dispute in his congregation is like a dispute in his family. Now, another very, very important point about all this is that embracing our role in the family cannot be done without God's grace. All earthly relationships are relationships between sinners. And this comes back to the original point I made about being realistic in setting expectations for families and expectations for our own family. As long as we are in a family in this world, it's going to be a family of sinners. And so for there to be harmony in the family, there needs to be daily grace sought for, grace to exercise patience, forbearance, and forgiveness. There's that humorous story of Martin Luther. He talked a lot about family life. He liked to tease his wife and say, your name is Katie, but he would nickname her Ketty, the German word for chain. Chain. And they were really good at teasing each other. And there's one time, I think he had a really busy day, and he was wanting to drop into a book. He's managing all these people problems, and he's glad to finally get home and just read a book. And then his wife calls from the kitchen and says, "Husband, who is the leader of Prussia now?" And he says, "Patience, patience, patience. All my life is patience. I'd have to exercise patience everywhere I go." So he had a really trying day, I guess, when he'd been outside the home, and instead of getting to relax at home, he was having to answer all kinds of questions. Right. All right. So obviously, the one general duty of every member is kindness to one another. Be ye kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, and walk in love. Then coming more to specific duties of family members. Here's where I'm going to get very politically incorrect. When you look at Paul's order in teaching about family relationships, he doesn't start with the superior. Yeah, that's what we might expect. But if you go through Ephesians 5 and 6, what you see him doing over and over is starting with the inferior, or the person under authority, and then moving to the duties of the superior. So, in Ephesians 5, wives are addressed first. Heard a story of a man in America, attends some Presbyterian church there, and he was on holiday with his family, vacation, but I think that's a better word. Vacation, holiday means holy day. So he's on vacation with his family, and he was in another Presbyterian church, and this man told him about the series that his minister was going through. It was a series on Ephesians, I think. And the minister had reached Ephesians 5. And he got all the way up to the point about duties of the wife to submit to her husband. And he actually took the next Sabbath off. He says, I need an extra Sabbath to prepare for this topic. So he brought in a guest preacher. And he comes back and says, everybody knows, yep, he's going to be preaching on Ephesians 5, 22, I think, why submit to your husbands. And what does he do? He starts off his sermon talking about the duties of husbands. Now, husbands, they got to do this and they got to do that. And by the end of the sermon, he'd hardly said a thing about the duties of the wife. Right? So there's this danger of inverting the order that Paul follows here. First, he addresses the wives. We can't skirt around that. Then he addresses the duties of the husbands. You go to chapter 6. First, he addresses the duties of children. Then he addresses the duties of parents, specifically fathers. So those under authority are addressed first, and then those in authority. So we're already at 52 minutes, so I don't think we're going to get through the specific duties of family members. But how much more time do I have?
Yeah. 15 minutes.
15 minutes, okay. Yeah, we're just going to have to pass over these. I'll set them out here. Paul sets down two specific duties of wives to their husbands. First is submission. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. Also reverence, so respect. Let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself. And the wife see that she reverence her husband. I wish I had more time to speak about this error. It's very, very common in the American church scene. It's a way of getting around the fact that wives do have to submit to their husbands. And they call it mutual submission. It's a misunderstanding of Ephesians 5, verse 21. Submitting yourselves to one another in the fear of God. And they will say, well, there you go. Husbands have to submit to their wives too. So there's mutual submission. Well, the problem with that is Paul goes on to talk about how the church submits to Christ in everything. In no sense does Christ submit to his church. He serves his church, but he doesn't submit to her as if she has authority over him. So the correct interpretation is that all who submit to authority must do so in the fear of God. This includes wives, it includes children, it includes servants or employees, as we would call them today. So you may have a husband that works as a servant or as an employee in the workplace, and he has to submit to his master or employer in the fear of God. Right, then we have, of course, the duties of husbands to their wives. Very, very high duty, which all husbands will feel. They fall far short in this when they meditate on the love of Christ, his unconditional love, his faithful love, his fervent love for his church. All these are lessons for themselves, of course. I just would point out one thing about the duties of husbands and wives. And it was something I read by an old writer a long time ago. I don't remember his name. But he says that Paul is reminding each spouse of the duty they are most likely to be deficient in. And in his opinion, husbands are most likely to be deficient in the duty of love, and wives most likely to be deficient in the duty of submission. And if I remember correctly, it was also him that pointed out, it's hard for wives to submit to an unloving husband. It's almost like, it feels like tyranny, having to submit to a man who has no love for you at all. But at the same time, it is hard for husbands to love an unsubmissive wife. His nature is one of leading and ruling. And if his wife does not want to submit, it's very hard for him to fulfill his role. But you know, there's other duties that bound up in the duty of loving one's wife. Just as Christ provides for his church, so the husband is to provide for his wife and children. Even the world knows that. If any man provide not for his own, especially for those of his own house, he's denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Love includes protection. So Christ laid down his life for his church, so husbands must be ready to lay down their lives to protect their family. That's why historically, until only very recent times, it was only men that fought in battles. Those who have the leading role in the home are those that must protect the home and be willing to sacrifice their lives. So it's no coincidence that when male headship was rejected by society, the idea of a male-only military was set aside too. And love includes exercising lawful authority. They don't just lead by example. They do have to exercise authority. Paul speaks about elders ruling their own families well, or their own houses. I say that because there's this idea of servant leadership, the idea that a person is a leader only by being a really good servant. And there's just truth to that. But the leader does exercise authority too. So with authority comes responsibility and sacrifice. All right, so I'm going to skip through the duties. Well, the one thing I'd like to say about the duties of children is something I pointed out to the young men in the Sabbath school and the young ladies too, is that Paul speaks about the duty of children to obey. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Respect for authority is first learned in the home. So if the home breaks down, there's going to be a lot of rebellion and disorder and lawlessness in society. And if we don't like restraints when we're under authority, we're not going to like restraints when we're in authority. And if you think about it, what does that mean? What's a person who doesn't like any kind of restraint on his authority? Tyrant. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if you did a study of people that are tyrants and you examine their childhood, and you would probably find in many cases a person who is very, very rebellious. You know, I just don't like any restraints. And so when they grow up, they get into a position of authority, they haven't changed. I'm not going to be under any restraints. Nobody has the right to hold me back in what I want to do. So we'll skip through this difference between obedience and honor. This is very interesting, but again, we don't have time to go through it. We come to what is more practical and relevant to you all now, and that is preparation for marriage and family. Practical ways of preparing. Embrace the role you currently have in your home, because it will be very good preparation for whatever role the Lord has for you later on in life. I hope I don't bring down the tone too much, make it too light, but Mr. Smith was the oldest of seven. I was right in the middle. Today, he's the convener of the Youth Conference Committee, I'm not. See? See that? And I'm much more comfortable with him being convener, right? I think it fits him really well. I would feel like a fish out of water, right? It might be my duty someday, but I can see the wisdom.
Maybe I have too much unrestrained authority.
I accepted position of clerk of presbytery because I thought I'll never have to be moderator again. I have to stand up there and lead everything and control everything. Right. Okay, then another proper practical way to prepare for marriage and family is just develop a habit of redeeming the time. It's very, very important. Developing good work habits, daily self-denial, manners, courteousness, so forth. These are all very important habits to develop when you're still in the home. get the education and training you will need for your role. So when Adam and Eve got married, who was older?
Adam,
yes, by a few hours. That doesn't mean that the man always has to be older than his wife, obviously. But there's a practical lesson here, and that is, Adam probably was more knowledgeable than Eve when they were married. God had given him a specific command about not eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So he had, you might say, knowledge of spiritual things, which he would have passed on to Eve. He also had a knowledge of creation. He had named all the animals before Eve, or the woman, I should say, was created. Right? So he had a knowledge of creation before he got married. Now, this does not mean that, you know, that the man has to have more academic credentials than the woman. Historically, that was certainly the case. But we all know that knowledge can be gained in many different ways than just academic credentials, you know, skills and practical knowledge of earthly life, and so on and so forth. But a leader has to have knowledge. The wife has to reverence her husband. It's very hard to speak, just to use an obvious example. It's very hard for a wife to respect a husband that's an ignoramus and proud of it. I just go to work and then I come home and flip on the TV and, you know, drink beer, which is what a lot of men are like. Well, sadly. Well, it's pretty hard for a woman to respect someone like that, who's not trying to get knowledge, a knowledge of spiritual things, knowledge of earthly things, so that he can lead his family rightly. So I think there is something really significant here. Adam was older than Eve and more knowledgeable than Eve. So with all that getting, good understanding if you're a man. Seize the time you have right now to get knowledge, get understanding, get training if you wish to be a head of home. All right, these are the most important things. I've numbered them because before, the previous slide was just practical tips, you might say. So firstly, seek the Lord above all things. You have to settle it in your minds. It's more important for me to be united to Christ, united to Him spiritually, than for me to be united in marriage. It's a very grave mistake people make when they say, once I'm married, I have a home of my own, then I'll have more freedom, flexibility, free time to seek the Lord. It may not work out like that at all. So I'm not going to go as far as to say you have to be an assured believer before you enter the married state. Marriage is honorable in all, whether they're converted or not. But I think it's very important that for ourselves, we say, the most important thing for me is that I be united to Christ. That is infinitely more important than being united in marriage. Do not think of marrying anyone in the world. You're a baptized member of the visible church. Westminster Confession actually has something to say about this. A marriage should never be between heathens, gross idolaters, I think Jews and Roman Catholics, if I remember correctly. Obviously, if they've left Roman Catholicism and they've left Judaism, then you could marry them, but not when they're in that. And then, of course, thirdly, pray for a spouse who's also got this priority. The person is also saying, it's the most important thing for me to be united to Christ, far more important than being united in marriage to someone. That's the kind of spouse you need. Very clearly, Genesis 2 teaches that the Lord leads a man and a woman together in marriage. And so we ought to pray for that. pray that the Lord would lead you to the right person, just as he led the woman to the man. You are to wait, we should wait patiently on the Lord to provide a spouse. Joseph was kidnapped, sold as a slave at age 17. He worked as a slave for a while in Potiphar's house. Then he was falsely accused. He ended up in prison. And he was, I think, 30 years old when he was finally taken out of prison. And maybe sometime after that, he was then married. So for him, he had to wait. And this is something that's very difficult for young people, but very important. Willingness to wait on the Lord to provide a spouse. Very, very important, and I believe biblical point here. Seek the advice of parents and wise Christian friends when preparing for marriage and family. The reason why the parents have a right in the whole business is that they are gaining a son-in-law or a daughter-in-law. Their family is changing by the marriages of their children. I mean, a son-in-law is just that. It's a son in the eyes of the law, or a daughter in the eyes of the law. Legally a son or a daughter. And so the person you marry is going to change your family. It's changing the membership of your family. And so, of course, parents have a right to be involved then. And ordinarily, their wishes should be obeyed. I think that's clear from verses in 1 Corinthians 7. I haven't had time to really study them. The man having power over his virgin. You see that symbolized on wedding days where the bride is on the arm of her father and taken up to the man and then handed to the man. Right? I think that's actually based on Scripture. And wish we had time to speak about this, but the importance of compatibility. But I'll have to stop.
2 more minutes.
Wow. Right. I do think it is very important, and I think here is where the modern secular mindset has come in. A lot of collective wisdom lost in this area. And, you know, true Christians, this is really solemn, but true Christians, two of them, both genuinely godly, may not be fit for each other. And if they're not compatible, their godliness will not necessarily overcome that incompatibility. This is a scriptural principle for making sure that your partner is compatible. Paul says, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. So, yes, it might be lawful for you to marry someone who is a true Christian or has some kind of profession of Christianity. It might be lawful, but it may not be expedient because you're just not very compatible. The person might be a godly person, but the Lord did not just provide a godly wife for Adam. He provided a help meet. Meet means suitable. So he provided a godly woman, yes, but also a suitable woman. Again, to go back to the French Revolution, they emphasized the common humanity of all. They would say things like, we need to ignore and erase even all the natural differences in the human race. We just need to ignore them, pretend like they don't exist. We're all human beings, right? And this emphasis has intensified after the world wars. People said, well, the way to prevent all world wars is just break down national borders, ignore all distinctions that God has made in the human race. This is the way that will prevent another world war, is by just trying to eradicate all the distinctions that God has made in the human race. They'll say things like this: well, peace and equality won't happen until all natural differences are destroyed. So this secular mindset does come into the church when they say, yeah, all that matters is that we marry in the Lord. All that matters is that the person is a Christian. If the person is a Christian, doesn't matter what their background is, what their interests are, what their how different their upbringing was from mine. That's all irreverent, all irrelevant. All that matters is that he or she is a Christian. I don't have time to go through this, so just ignore the first point up there and just focus on this. Natural differences, we're born with certain traits that affect our intelligence, our personality, our talents. This affects things like wealth, social standing, choice of careers, likes, dislikes. God has created these differences amongst human beings, and we're not taught to ignore them. Yeah, we do see in a person, every single person here, I see a soul worth more than the whole world. But at the same time, we don't just see souls. We see people who have bodies and minds and personalities. You're all different from each other. And we have to be aware of these things in the choice of a marriage partner. Yeah, these things shape our upbringing, tastes, and preferences. So now this is very important. Not every difference makes people incompatible. I doubt there's ever been a perfect match. part of becoming one flesh. I mean, yes, when the minister is marrying a couple or solemnizing a marriage, he pronounces them one flesh, quoting scripture. You are now no more twain, but one flesh. But after marriage, there is a growing together. There is, you might say, a process of becoming one flesh, more and more and more. And so, by grace, some incompatibilities can be overcome. Mutual love for Christ and His church makes a lot of these natural differences insignificant. But people who have a lot of very significant natural differences may be incompatible for each other. They might be true Christians, but there's just too many natural differences to make the marriage a good one.